welcome to episode 7 of Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast, Ride 'em Cowboy. I'm Jerry Shario, and my main job here is to introduce to you the host of our little party, actor, director, playwright, musician, author, not the Nina, not the Pinta, it's Nick Santamaria.
Whoa, that was, wow, referencing Columbus's ships.
Yes.
Only I have a bigger deck. That was a clean statement. It was clean.
It was perfect.
Dirty. It implied dirty, but it was clean. Yeah. Jerry, it's so good to see you as usual.
Yes,
as
you
per
do.
Usual. Now you are, before we get on with the lucky Mickey Mantle number 7, sorry, I'm an old Yankee fan. Jerry, you're rehearsing a new show, aren't you?
I are. It's Disney's Beauty and the Beast.
Uh-huh.
I had to think for a second there. It's Disney's Beauty and the Beast.
I hope you have a better memory on stage.
Yeah, well, we'll soon find out. The fun thing about this will be the third production of this show that I've been involved with.
Is it always the same role?
No. Hmm. First one, which was mucho years ago, I played Cogsworth.
Okay.
And then last time was Maurice, Belle's father, and that's the role I'm playing again this time around. And there's just... probably appreciate and identify with the fact there's just something so interesting and exciting and entertaining to revisit a show, even if it's in a different role.
Right. True.
But the dynamic it obviously is different because it's different people. And you have that mixture of, oh, I remember when, and oh, this is fun.
But it's also, I don't know, you probably have experienced this. When you're at a party and somebody gives you like a straight line and you don't think of it at the time, and when you're driving home, you say, damn it, I could have said da-ba-da. This is an opportunity to fix all the times you said, oh, I should have done this, or I could have added this, you know. So yeah, you could correct things or even take away things that you weren't crazy about that you created the first time. So yeah, that's a lot of fun. That with Forum. I got to play Pseudolus like 5 times. And the producers, I played almost every male role several times. So yeah, I've experienced that quite a bit. And I would love to see you in that part. playing the man with the Larry Fine hair.
Yes.
It's good to have fine hair.
It is. It's good to have hair, period. But, you know.
Oh, please. For those of you who don't see Jerry, let's just say that his earphones right now are the only things on top of his head. Okay, so we're moving on.
Please, yes.
I'm sorry, Joe. Okay. Well, we are talking today. We are moving on with our Abbott and Costello journey, their film journey, this is. And this is another weird situation as far as what's going on at Universal Studios. Universal is ultra sensitive as to what is happening with Abbott and Costello right now and the general public. There is a love affair, a public love affair going on, and Universal is very aware of it because they're collecting the money from the box office, and they are just going for the most they can get in the shortest amount of time. I will say that the pervading mood is what usually happens when there's a big hit and a few sequels. They realize it's going to peter out after a short while. Boy, they didn't realize this was going to be like 15 years. So that love affair never went away. It waned occasionally, but it never went away. So they're looking at the fact that America at the moment is draft crazy. People are being drafted. People are going into the service. They're going through basic training, and the country is reacting. So what happens? Ride 'em Cowboy is supposed to be their third movie. The boys, their buddies, Fred Rinaldo and Robert Lees, put together a treatment right after Hold That Ghost. And Hold That Ghost wasn't even their second film, and it was supposed to be. So what they did was they took the treatment for Ride 'em Cowboy. They put it into development. And in the meantime, they did another service comedy. They did Keep 'em Flying and released it there. So the actual last released film by director Arthur Lubin was Ride 'em Cowboy. But the last actual film he directed was Keep 'em Flying. So if you could keep track of this, you know, it's all in our book, The Annotated Abbott and Costello. You can read about it there. And if you can't do that, you can have someone read it to you. or you could just go on a vacation and eat fish. So let's see. I'm back. I have no idea, Jerry. That was silly. This is why serious people don't come on our podcast.
Exactly.
You know, I've been trying to get Kevin Brownlow for generations and nothing. Okay, so we're talking about Ride'em Cowboy. The treatment was done by the two boys I told you about, the guys who eventually gave us Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. And then once they got down to the movie itself, it went through several hands. The original treatment was by the two boys I mentioned. Then there was a story taken out. They liked some of the stuff in the treatment, and the story by Edmund Hartman was put together. And then it was adapted by Harold Schumann. And then the final script was by Abbott and Costello veterans, True Boardman, and John Grant. And we all know John Grant. He's the man that fit those burlesque routines into the scripts after the scripts were written. Very interesting process. And, you know, the boys brought John Grant. So it really was their idea. So the movie is a fun one. There's a lot of great stuff in it, but I don't think it's a great movie. I have to say, it's just, you know, shuffling these movies around created a little, maybe confusion in the editing department, because in this movie, I just don't get it. I mean, I get it, but it took me a while to really get the finale and what Bronco Bob was trying to do with the betting mm-hmm. and betting against himself, blah, blah, blah. It's so convoluted. And then there's the whole romantic triangle that never quite comes off and is never explored. It's yep. it's shown, and then, yeah, right, Jerry? It's just yep. dumped
yep.
after a while. It's like they got bored with it or something. I think it's just poor editing, and they were just mm-hmm. a little too rattled with the, you know, like I said, the order of the films being changed so much. The cast is terrific. I know through past podcasts that you know that Dick Foran is a favorite of mine. I just think he's maybe their best leading man. You know, he's rugged. He's good. He sings really well. And, mm-hmm. you know, he can handle the love scenes. He's just really, really good. And so the movie opens with that great theme song. We stand together side by side. All right, somebody shoot me before I go further. And so this wonderful opening title sequence comes on, gets us in the mood, and we find ourselves in New York City at Madison Square Garden. Now, this is a black tie event. It's a benefit, and appearing is Bronco Bob Mitchell. Now, Bronco Bob Mitchell, played by Dick Foran, is a novelist. He writes Western stories. He's sort of the, what's his name?
Zane Grey?
Yes. So Zane Grey, he writes, but he doesn't know how to do the things he says he does. So he writes under the guise of Bronco Bob Mitchell. He's the hero of these Western stories, but he's never been out of New Jersey. So he's there, and there's a very vengeful, very rotten columnist played by the great Charles Lane.
Oh, and yes.
He's wearing his cranky pants here. he seldom took them off, in fact.
Yeah.
And I knew his wife. But no, I never went down that lane. But we're talking about him being very, you got to keep up with the jokes. So Charles wants to prove that Bronco Bob Mitchell is full of excrement. And he writes in his column that he's never been near a horse. He's never been on a horse. So Bronco Bob proves him wrong by getting on a beautiful white horse and singing one of my favorite cowboy songs of all time, Give Me My Saddle. Now, when I was a kid, I will admit, this was a song. You went and made a sandwich, and you came down, and you waited for Abbott and Costello. As I got older, I realized just how beautiful this song is. And not just the way he sings it, which is really, really nice. And the horse is so well behaved. Have you noticed that, Jerry? It just stood there the whole time. It's like they gave a drug, you know?
Yes. It made me look twice. It really did. Yeah.
Yeah, me too. Me too. That was a very, very stoic horse. Mm-hmm. Maybe he liked Dick Foran's voice. Who knows? But anyway, he also whistles. He has a whistling chorus that he does as the horse is taking him around the ring. doubting it was him. I'm doubting he whistled. I'm thinking Elmo Tanner, who was the great whistler in that song Heartaches by Ted Weems.
Oh, yeah.
I can't do it. But Heartaches, Heartaches. He was a very famous whistler. He had a mother, too, from what I understand. So anyway, he sings the song. All the women are ooing and aahing, but especially lovely Anne Gwynn. Are you in love with Anne Gwynn? I am.
Oh, yes. Definitely. Oh, my gosh. All of a sudden, your face looked like it was drawn by Tex Avery right there.
I do look a little drawn. You know, I always said this, Jerry. Universal was an A-minus studio. It wasn't up there. It was never listed with MGM, Fox, Paramount. It was always just a shade below. But I'll tell you the truth. They had the prettiest leading ladies in Hollywood. I mean, Grace Bradley and Anne Gwynn and Ginny Sims and Debbie Reynolds. All right, maybe not Debbie Reynolds. Beautiful, beautiful girls. Who's the other? Oh, Martha O'Driscoll, Peggy Moran. All right, I'm going to get off that. Yeah. Oh, I love Peggy. The Mummy's Hand, which also had Dick Foran in it. But anyway, so Anne Gwynn is you know, taken with Barco Bob and his image. And Anne Gwynn plays the daughter of Samuel S. Hines, who shows up in, it seems like, every Abbott and Costello movie. And they own a dude ranch. And did you get this? Did your mind go there when you saw the name of the dude ranch, the Lazy S? How did they get away with that?
Yes.
I mean, seriously, I that had to be an inside joke, and you know,
yep.
The lazy ass.
Yep.
Okay, that's the name of the dude ranch that they have out west. And she's planning on riding in the rodeo as well, and she's up for a $10,000 prize, and she's a shoo-in from what we understand. Mm-hmm. Okay, we meet our two stars. Bud and Lou play Duke and Willoughby. You can decide which one is which. And we open with a gag that was presented to us probably by Max Sennett in the 1910s. And that's where Lou looks like he's on a horse. The horse is in front of him, actually. Mm-hmm. And when the horse moves away, you see he's on a fence that was next to the horse. So it's a great gag, but it's about 1,000 years old, even by that point. So, yeah, Lou is afraid of Western things. He's afraid of horses, you know, whatever. He's just afraid. And Bud and Lou eventually do one of my favorite Bud and Lou jokes.
I was standing right next to a real live jackass.
Do you ever ride a jackass?
No.
Well, you want to get onto yourself. Come on. Peanuts.
I get it. Think I'm a dummy. Hot dogs. Red hot. Hot dog.
Hot dog.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever ride a jackass?
No.
No? Jump on my back.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorites. you know, there are certain jokes in certain films that you remember because your family laughed at them. You know what I mean? You were sitting with maybe your brothers and your sister. That joke never failed to get us giggling and laughing out loud. So anyway, Bud and Lou are peanut and hot dog salesmen at this Madison Square Garden event. And of course, they are not good at their jobs. So I talked about this during Keep 'Em Flying, that I said the opening scenes to me are worth the price of admission alone. I feel that way about this scene where they're selling peanuts to the black tie crowd. And snooty Isabel Randolph is sitting in the front. And it's Isabel Randolph. And Lou throws some peanuts to a guy, and the guy throws the change, and it's a 50-cent piece. Lou misses it, and it goes down the back of the woman's dress. And that begins the whole thing, you know, of trying to do it without actually sticking your hand down the woman's back. It's very funny. Bud tries to get the lady to change her seat so she'll stand up and the money will fall through. And he says, we'll get you another seat. And she says, I paid $1 for this seat. And Lou says, well, you just got 50 cents change. And eventually it falls into her shoe, which leads them to give her a hot foot so she'll take off the shoe. But they accidentally do it to the boss who happens upon them at the right moment. This causes them to be chased, and this begins the film proper. They run and hide in the pen where they keep all the cows and bulls. And when they realize where they are, they get scared, open up the pen, and one of the bulls gets loose. Okay, I just want to bring up one thing. During this moment, Lou makes my favorite Lou Costello noise. It was the same recording they used. It, it, taken from Hold That Ghost when he's left alone in the room that keeps changing. He goes, hoo, 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 like that.
Yeah. They
use the same sound when he runs out of the fence. And it's just great. But anyway, the bull gets loose and it starts running towards Bronco Bob, who falls off his horse as Anne Gwynn bulldogs the steer by herself. And Bronco Bob Mitchell is laying on the floor like a young girl. So she gets hurt doing it. I mean, this is a fully, you know, Brahma bull with the horns and everything. And so here's something. Ella Fitzgerald. Now, Jerry, you agree with me. She's probably known as the greatest female jazz singer of all time, right?
Oh, yes.
And here she's playing Anne Gwynn's maid. And it's, I'm not usually thrown by this kind of stuff because I know it was the time, but this hurts. This one hurts, you know? Yes, ma'am. Yes. Oh, yeah. You know, all of that. And it's like, no. But it's her first movie, and you could tell I caught her in two mistakes that were left on film. While Anne is in her tent on her bed, the doctor is telling her that she can't ride. And she says, but no, I have to ride. And Ella is supposed to say, she sure does. But the doctor missed her cue and talked over. And she still says the line while the doctor is talking. So it's like underneath the doctor. You could barely recognize it, but you could see that's you know, a first timer. Later on, when they're doing the song in the barn, the square dance song, she starts mouthing the lyrics like a measure too soon. She corrects it real quickly. Yeah. But yeah, you know, but it's Ella. You forgive her anything.
Oh, yeah.
That out of the way, we find out that she can't ride. She loses the $10,000 check that was going to come with that. Bud and Lou apologize because they're really to blame. And they come off like real comedy relief in that scene. I hate to say it, but they still look like comedy relief a little bit. So then Bronco Bob comes in and he feels terrible, of course, and he offers her $10,000 because he's a rich man. He's a very successful, you know, liar. So she, of course, says, no, I don't want it. Get the hell out of here. Blah, blah, blah. What kind of man are you? You're supposed to be Bronco Bob. Anyway, so he feels terrible. He walks out and he drops the check on the floor. Lou walks by and happens to pick it up. And he looks down and he goes, oh, look at this, a check for $10,000. Just my luck, it's not made out to me. And he tears it up. And Bud says, who was it made out to? And he says, some guy named Cash. So after this happens, Bronco Bob tells his manager, who's played by Richard Lane. Now, Richard Lane's a fascinating guy. And in my book, sometimes I say, you know, as the movies progressed, Bud became less the feed guy, feeding, you know, Lou, just there to feed Lou, as he became more of a character actor and a character in the movies. But I said there are certain characters that he played in the films where Richard Lane could have done just as well. And that's nothing against Bud. I'm just saying that if we had, let's say there wasn't a Bud, Richard Lane would have been a great replacement. In fact, if there was no Bud, I would say that Richard Lane would have been a great partner for Lou. He was a partner for, not a partner, but, you know, he did play feed to Joe Penner in about three films for RKO in the late 30s, and they worked very well together. That's my Joe Penner laugh.
Sounded more like a duck. I'm sorry. I don't know.
You want to buy one?
Yeah.
So, okay. So where was I? Oh, yeah. So Richard Lane plays his manager. And he's told that Bronco Bob is going to the Lazy Ass Ranch, and he's going to learn to be a real cowboy. And he's going to get Anne Gwynn, the girl he seems to have a spark for, will teach him, according to him. She doesn't know this yet, but okay. So Bud and Lou are being chased. They are led to a train where all of the cows are put into the freight car. They are among them. The train stops at a train yard, and Bud and Lou get out with the cows and immediately are chased by two railroad cops because they, you know, they've stowed away. Now, these cops are James Flavin.
Flavin.
That's a great name for Jerry Lewis. James Flavin. But he was from in the original cast of King Kong, actually. He was one of the crew members and became everybody's favorite Irish cop. Eddie Dunn, who was very big at Hal Roach Studios and all the other comedy studios. He was a great comedy supporting guy, Eddie Dunn. So these two guys are chasing Bud and Lou. And this is one of my favorite parts of the movie. They stop to look around. Lou sees a cord and thinks it's a horn. And he pulls it and all the water comes out of the water tank on the two detectives, right? Like a shower almost, but really big. And they stand there going, hey, what? What? And I'm just thinking, in true old-time comedy, you know, trope, is that they have to stand there instead of immediately get out of the way.
Yes.
So, yeah.
That's the old Laurel and Hardy thing, you know? I'm going to do an indignity to you, and you have to stand there and take it, and then I will reciprocate.
My favorite part of Laurel and Hardy is their battles with Charlie Hall, the little pit bull. So he's a dangerous man. So trained. They were being trained. Blah, blah, blah.
Yep.
Bud and Lou get into a poker game with a bunch of tough cowboys. And Lou alerts us that this is supposed to be another version of the dice game from Buck Privates. He even says, is this anything like dice? And sort of with a wink to the audience. He never played it before, just like dice. He sits down. He gets everything wrong. There are some laughs, definitely. There's, where's your auntie? Oh, she's home with my uncle. Put money in the pot. He puts it in the coffee pot, blah, blah, blah. So it's not as good as the dice game. Lou, of course, wins everything. And they get off the train, finally. Lou has all of the cowboy's clothing. That's how well he won. And when they get off the train, not only do we meet Johnny Mac Brown. For those of you, the uninitiated, Johnny Mac Brown was quite the B-movie cowboy hero, especially at Universal. And he happened to be Lou Costello's favorite movie star. I had lunch with Patty Costello, Lou's oldest daughter, a while ago. And while we were sitting there, she told me that Lou loved B-Westerns and would run them in his screening room all the time. And his favorite was Johnny Mac Brown. Now, Johnny Mac Brown started out as a college football hero, was signed by MGM. They had high hopes for him as a Clark Gable-like leading man. Unfortunately, he had really good looks, but he couldn't act his way out of a paper bag. He sounded like this, like he had a, you know, an accent like that, you know. It didn't really work that well. He was a better cowboy, let's put it that way. So Lou got to make a movie with his cowboy hero, you know, and it basically is a B-Western starring two A comedians.
Yeah.
Interesting. So, we meet Alabama. That's his name, Johnny Mac Brown. He embraces Anne Gwynn, and he's obviously her boyfriend. They walk off arm in arm after Bronco Bob makes his presence known. And Anne Gwynn's father, Samuel S. Hines, is really happy that Bronco Bob is there. It's going to mean a lot for the Dude Ranch. And he's going to ride for the big charity event in the rodeo. And that's, you know, if he learns his lessons from Anne Gwynn. That's the trope here. Now, I just want to throw a couple of things up. This is not exactly an original idea. Let's put it that way.
No.
MGM in 1930 made a film called Way Out West. Now, not the Laurel and Hardy version from 1937. This is 1930, and it starred William Haynes, a big leading man in the silent days, was kind of pushed out of movies because he was gay. He was openly gay, and Hollywood didn't like that at the time. This was about a guy who was supposedly a cowboy and didn't know anything about being a cowboy, and he has a young lady teach him. There's also a movie called Cowboy from Brooklyn in 1938, starring Dick Powell and Dick Foran. And that's about a guy who has a reputation as a cowboy and doesn't know how to do anything. And Priscilla Lane is the pretty girl that teaches him. So this is pretty much a cockamamie, you know, B-movie idea. But thankfully, we have Bud and Lou there. So if you listen to old comedies on the radio, like I do, you hear a lot of things about Indian blankets being sold in the West when you get off the train. There were always Native Americans sitting there with their homemade blankets. Actually, they probably got them from someplace in New Jersey, and they would sell them to the suckers that got off the train. So this is what happens with Bud and Lou. They come across an Indian tribe that is selling souvenirs, and the head of the tribe and the head salesman is none other than one of my favorite villains of all time, Douglas Dumbriel, who Bud and Lou will encounter in the future. in a couple more movies. But here he is playing Jake Rainwater, the chief of this tribe. And he sells them a bottle of water. It's called spring water, mountain spring water. And it comes with a little bow and arrow for Lou.
Hey, dude, what? A real genuine Indian bow and arrow.
What do you mean genuine? Made in Cleveland.
Well, didn't you ever hear of Cleveland Indians?
Oh, now stop.
One of the oldest jokes in baseball. But anyway, the rainwater is a scam. It squirts in his face. So he gets mad and shoots the arrow, misses Jake Rainwater, and shoots it into the heart that is printed onto the teepee of the chief's daughter. Now, one of my favorite moments in the movie comes at this point where the chief says to Lou,
"You shot an arrow through the heart of her teepee. Therefore, you must marry her."
So, yeah, so that there's that moment. So he has to marry the daughter, according to this tribe's law. So he goes over and he yells out for Moonbeam. That's her name, Moonbeam. And this beautiful woman walks out, this beautiful Native American woman, who is probably a, you know, from New Jersey, a universal starlet. She informs him that she's Sunbeam and her sister is Moonbeam. And you can only imagine what Moonbeam looks like. Moonbeam happens to be Jodie Gilbert, who we love. She was the waitress for W.C. Fields in Never Give a Sucker an Even Break. And she just went on to make great appearances in movies for the rest of her life into the 1970s. Maybe 80s. But she turns out to be Moonbeam. Lou gets one look at her and runs away. Because let's face it, she's too fat. And Lou Costello is not fat at all. Anyway. that was for Jody. So anyway, they have to make a quick escape. And everybody who's going to the lazy ass ranch, I'm sorry, I knew that was going to happen, gets onto a chartered bus. And Bud and Lou just happen to hop onto the back of it and make their escape from the Native Americans, who are intent now on marrying Moonbeam off to Lou. Okay, so that's a whole side plot. This is where Ella Fitzgerald sings her first hit from 1938, A Tisket, A Tasket. And she is the co-writer on this with a guy by the name of Al Feldman. It was a huge hit, and it was still a very popular song at the time.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, and she sings it with everybody's there. The Merry Macs are there, the singing group that are not the Andrews sisters. Samuel S. Hines is enjoying himself. Everybody's there enjoying himself, singing along. And this is a special moment for most Abbott and Costello fans because they pop up in the back at two moments where it's very funny. So do we. And they pop back down again. And then Lou comes up when they're talking about the color of the basket.
Was it red?
No.
Was it green?
No.
Was it cerise?
No. Just a little basket.
So anyway, that was a big hit, very big hit. And they pull into the ranch. Bud and Lou get off knowing that they've got to get jobs. They encounter Johnny Mac Brown, who is nice enough to give them jobs as ranch hands. And before they start anything, Lou notices how luxurious this place is. It's a dude ranch. And it was very luxurious. And he says, "And look at the big bathtub." And of course, it's the swimming pool. And Bud coerces him into giving a display of diving. Now, why he came up with this, I have no idea. And I mean, Lou does a wonderful physical display on the high board, and he ends it by jumping off the high board, landing on the lower board, and breaking it as he goes down into the water. It's a wonderful moment. And it opened the 8mm version that I had, that I grew up with, and you didn't need sound.
No.
Chaplin was right. He was the best. What kills me about the scene, though, is that Lou falls into the water. And he's drowning. He doesn't know how to swim. Bud says to everybody around him, "Save him. He doesn't know how to swim." Why did he want Lou to do a diving performance if he knew he couldn't swim? This is my, you know, this is the burlesque relationship. This is why people get confused. You know, I thought they were friends.
It's because diving and swimming are two different things. So it doesn't matter.
They definitely are spelled differently. I'll give you that. I've been in a few dives. I've never been in a few swims. So it's different. So there's that whole diving scene, which is a lot of fun. Good physical comedy. I really like Bronco Bob. I think he's a really decent character.
Mm-hmm.
Everything he does is for good. You know, did you notice that?
Yes.
He represents like big corporate America because he's part of he's an industry, basically. But the character is very down to earth and very helpful. I like him. Okay, so they're at the dude ranch. They have a job. Their first task is to rope Wildcat. Now, what does that mean? Johnny Mac Brown wants Dick Foran to pick out his horse. And he knew he'd be a great judge of horse flesh. So he points to like one that looks the most out of shape. And of course, Alabama tells him, boy, you really do know your horse flesh. That's the toughest horse in the barn and blah, blah. So of course he picks the worst horse. That's Wildcat. And it's up to Bud and Lou to rope Wildcat, bring him in so they can saddle him up for Dick Foran. That doesn't happen. Bud, of course, gives the job to Lou because he doesn't want everyone to think that he's afraid. That's one of Bud's big things. You want them to think I'm a coward? You want them to think I'm afraid? Oh, no, I don't want that. So Lou does some great physical stuff with the rope. He gets it on his face and all that stuff. Did you notice everybody watching him on the fence?
Yes.
They're having a great old time.
They were loving it, and I can't blame them either.
I can't either. When he trips over the little horse, it's very funny. It really is funny. So eventually he ends up on the horse, and it becomes the torpedo scene from Keep 'Em Flying.
Yep.
Basically, it's out of control. His belt buckle is stuck to the horn of the saddle, so he can't fall off. And he's taken for the ride of his life. Bud eventually gets onto the back, where just like the torpedo. And it ends where the horse is just exhausted at that point. Did you see how it was sweating at the end of that
scene? Yes, my gosh, there's foam coming off of this horse.
It was amazing. I never saw a horse sweat so much in my life. So they get off and Bud immediately faints. Lou says, he can't take it. And then, of course, he faints too. So that was their big slapstick scene. Before they get to a song that I love, it is so dreamy. I don't know about you, Jerry, but I'm a big old song fan. I used to have to listen to songs privately when I was a kid. And I find this song to be one of the prettiest songs in fact, there are two songs in this movie. If you add the first one, I'd say three, that are just so beautiful. I can't get them out of my head. And I'm an old song fan, like I say. This one is called On the Rio Tonto Shore. Now, I know it doesn't scream hit, but it is so beautiful. And their harmonies are so gorgeous. They were quite influential, the Merrimacks. Those were three brothers, the McMichaels, and a woman by the name of, Marie? Anyway, her name's like Mary Lee Cooper or something like that. I'll probably get yelled at. But they formed a harmony that nobody else ever heard before. Mm-hmm. And they really work in this film. It is just wonderful. Fred Allen had them as regulars on his radio show before he went with the DeMarco sisters, who were also great harmonists.
That's siblings. You know, you get a group of siblings singing together, and it sounds beautiful. Yeah.
Oh, no, absolutely. It's just gorgeous. So this song is just, there's a little touch of it.
Beside the Rio Tonto on a starlit trail, fell in love with her smile one autumn while the moon was pale. And he knew that she loved him just by the look that she wore that evening beside the Rio Tonto shore.
Okay, great song. So, the Hi-Hatters. The Hi-Hatters are what you would call a flash act. They would come out and do really the same act they've been doing for decades. And they're in this movie, but they're not billed and they're not introduced. And unless you knew your stuff, you really wouldn't know who they were. But they get a very short amount of time to do their stuff before they do a big production number, big square dance number. But anyway, there's an interesting thing about this movie. There's a scene where Bud and Lou are sitting on a fence or a wall, okay? A short wall, like Humpty Dumpty. And they're watching everybody dance in the barn, you know, whatever. And Lou is feeding a baby pig, his little pig. And he's feeding it with a bottle. And before you know it, both Bud and Lou are pulled off the wall from behind, and they are abducted by the Indians, the Native Americans. So they're warned, and then they cut the song, and then they cut back to Bud and Lou, who are back on the wall, but they're wet, they're sweaty from running. You know, they're out of breath and sweating. Mm-hmm. And you're wondering, they just fell backwards and were given a warning. What happened was there is a cut scene. They cut the scene at Universal. The movie was running too long. The Indians abducted them, brought them back to their village, put Lou at a stake to burn him. Bud thinks fast, grabs the baby pig and brings it to Moonbeam and says, I'll give you this if you let Willoughby go. So what she does, she wants to think about it. She puts the pig in a basket, right? So while they're doing something else, an Indian maiden comes by with her papoose, takes the pig out of the basket and puts the baby in the basket. So when Moonbeam is taking Jake Rainwater, Douglas Dumbrill, to show the pig, it becomes this big thing that was actually, this was cut by the censor, actually. This was not for time. This was the censor. They're saying, oh, look in here. This is what Willoughby gave me. And there's a baby in there, and it becomes 10 times worse, and they escape, and they run away, and that's why they're sweating. So, yeah, that whole thing was lost. Yeah, and it's funny stuff. That's really good stuff.
Yeah, I was not aware of that at all. And, you know, quite honestly, I was not surprised that a decision would have been made. This film is running long. This film, Abbott and Costello film, is running long. So let's cut the comedy. I would not be surprised at that attitude.
The wisdom of Hollywood during this.
Yes.
You know what? Let's put in an opera number and we'll cut Harpo scene over here. But anyway, this also leads to one of my favorite scenes, and that's milking the cow.
Yes.
And that's also in the 8mm version. They do the herd of cows routine, of course.
Hey.
What?
Do I have to milk that bunch of cows?
No, not bunch. Herd.
Herd what?
Herd of cows.
Sure, herd of cows. What do you think I am, a dummy?
No, a cow herd.
What do I care for cow herd? I didn't say anything to be ashamed of. Oh,
please, do you know what a cow gives? A cow gives milk.
No, she don't. You got to take it away from her.
Oh, come on. Let's get over to the barn.
And then
come
the
on.
Whole milking the cow sequence where Lou doesn't know how to do it. At one point, he goes underneath the front of the cow and he can't reach the udders. And he says, would you bring the stuff over here? The stuff?
Yeah.
They don't read the script. I just love what they come up with, you know, on their own.
Yeah.
So anyway, they do the very, very old gag where the cow keeps hitting Lou in the face with the tail while he's trying to milk it. So in order to weigh the tail down so it won't hit him, he ties a wrench or a sledgehammer or whatever it is to the back of the tail. And of course it hits him again and knocks him out. And Bud comes by and says, fine time to take a nap. So in his true understanding, Bud Abbott.
Yes.
And that leads. Oh, excuse me. There's someone at my door. Just a second. Oh, hello. Yeah, is that for me? Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. Ooh, look at this from Kevin Brownlow UK. Oh, my goodness.
No,
I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to load this in. This is. I thought it was over. I didn't think there was another one. Okay, hold on.
I was hoping it was over, but that's okay.
This might be very exciting, Jerry. This could be. Hold on. There you go. Let's start this right now. Hold on. I'm going to hit it. Welcome to the Bud Abbott Variety Show. And here's everybody's favorite straight man, Bud Abbott. Yay! Thank you. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. You know, strange as it may seem, they give baseball players very funny names nowadays. But we'll get into that a little later. Right now, I'd like to introduce my special guests. And this is big, folks. Here they are, the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. Yay! And look at this young lady leading the group. Hello there. What's your name?
Ethel.
Oh, Ethel Mormon. That's nice. Good, good, good. I want to meet some of these young boys here. Look at this. There must be 300 of them here. Hello there, young man.
Hello, Mr. Abbott. I just want to...
Quiet! Who said you could talk? Stop being silly. I'm going to move over here. You, hello there. What's your name?
My name is...
Quiet! What are you doing? You're not supposed to talk. I have to pay you extra. All right, I'm moving over here. And what about you? Hi, you!
Boy, it ends there. That's weird. But, you know, I had read about that. I had read about that episode. And apparently, it took the entire hour to go through the 300 boys.
Yes.
And Bud actually broke some blood vessels in his, in his hand and had to take the following week off. So anyways, I want to thank Kevin Brownlow for getting that here on time for our audience.
Well, I'm glad you want to thank him, because I sure don't.
Oh, man, you thank him. He's... Okay, well, that was fun. All right, so moving on to what movie are we doing?
Oh, yeah.
Now, this is the hit song. Tisca the Tasket was a hit song in 1938-39. Yep. This song was written for Keep 'Em Flyin', actually, for Carol Bruce to do. But they decided not to do that, and they gave it to Dick Foran. And it's a song that became a standard. In fact, it's probably... Other than the Buck Private songs, Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy, and Apple Blossom Time, this may be the biggest hit from an Abbott and Costello film. It's called I'll Remember April, and it's just gorgeous. It's done at a midnight ride, you know, in the moonlight, and everybody's singing, and Dick Foran is just really has a beautiful voice for the song.
Alone where we have walked together, be glad.
It was recorded about 1,000 times by cover artists. My favorite being Martha Ray, believe it or not, does a jazzed up version of it. I believe it's on YouTube. She was on the Steve Allen Show doing it.
Wow.
Excellent. Yeah, really beautiful, Jerry. She is just, well, Martha Ray. So that is one of the key moments, I think, in early Abbott and Costello movies is I'll Remember April. It's just a gorgeous song. Okay, we're coming to my least favorite scene in the film. Actually, there's two of them. One leads into the other. You know what? They keep putting in things to scare Lou because Lou was so funny and hold that ghost, getting scared. So they put the gorilla in Keep 'Em Flying. Yeah. Here, it's a dummy of Jake Rainwater, the chief of the tribe. And the Merrimacks come in, we're going to scare him. And they put the dummy there. And of course, Lou does his business with that. And then the real Jake Rainwater comes in, takes the place of the dummy. And it basically becomes the handcuff bit, meaning the foil accidentally gets his hands in handcuffs and Lou torments him until he sees that the handcuffs are off. And then it becomes scared again. So this is kind of what that is, only, you know, the Indian. I keep saying the Indian. I'm sorry. I, you know what? Screw it. The Indian kept throwing the knife into the wall, you know, trying to kill him. It's just not. It's kind of lame. And then the ultimate lameness, and maybe the key reason I don't think this film is up to the previous ones, and that's the crazy house scene. They destroyed it.
Yes.
They destroyed one of the greatest hits burlesque ever produced by making it a dream sequence. It just takes away everything. That bit is supposed to be a nightmare for real, for the guy who's, for Lou, who wants to get some rest, right? Yeah. And you just could have made it like, let me put it this way. In the previous scene, Lou gets changed for bed, right? He's fully dressed. He walks into the closet with his nightgown. And then a second later, there's a cut. He walks out and he's fully dressed in his nightgown. And Bud says, oh, what took you so long? You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So they were afraid that this bit was going to be absurd. I just don't get it. I don't get it. It's so, so badly handled.
And, you know, I will agree with you on that point. I would even be willing to concede that point. Okay, you want to make it a dream? Fine, make it a dream. At the beginning, we're dreaming. But then they kept cutting. They fade back and forth, and it loses the momentum. There's no build to it. There's no nothing to it.
It's horrible.
And it's a great bit.
Well, when you're doing it correctly, yeah.
Yes.
But boy, this was not correct. These guys did not know what they were doing. And every time they cut back to Lou, you know, rolling around in bed, having the nightmare, they're just reminding us of how lame it is each time, you know, it goes back. And then, of course, it's a shortened version because, you know, there were some things that are kind of adult in that bit.
Yeah.
But no, they totally destroyed it, and it doesn't work at all. And it's a shame because it really could have used it at that point.
Yeah.
And then we get to the big square dance number in the barn. And that's another good song. You know, I missed another favorite song. There are a lot of songs in this movie, folks, which is a bad point to a lot of people. But to me, the songs are almost the best part of the movie. you know, yeah, I forgot the Merrimacks do when they get off the train. They sing, hurry up, wake up, wake up, Jacob. You can't go sleeping in the sun all day.
You got to keep jumping to amount to something. You got to get out and get some hay. So break it up and wake up, Jacob. You won't be president in that away.
It's also so American, the American work ethic. Wake up and go to work. It's so American. Yeah. In Europe, they think we're slaves. You know, they get, what is it, 6 weeks off a year, paid.
Yeah,
they take care of their people. Here it's like work, work. So they do this wonderful square dance. Do you know about the rocking and reeling? Anyway, I can go on and on, and I do. But then there's the condescension of in the middle of that bit, everybody's having a great time. All the white people are dancing, but then they stop and say, "Okay, Ella, you're from Harlem. What do you guys do?" And then all of a sudden, all the African-Americans come out and start singing and dancing with Ella. And they're workers. They work more, of course. And even Ella is like giving everybody lemonade while she's singing. It's, you know, it's the 40s. What are you going to do? But it's a great number, a lot of fun. And again, it comes at a time where it really needs the number. So this is what happens. Let's talk about the finale and the whole thing with the bedding.
If you can explain it, then yes, please do.
I will explain it. I figured it out.
Oh, okay.
Because when I was a kid, I had no idea what the hell they were talking about.
Yep.
Gangsters. They own a nightclub. They want to bet on the big charity rodeo that Bronco Bob is training for. So Bob overhears that they are betting against... Wait a minute. Oh, God, this is terrible.
It's not easy.
It's not. It's so confusing. Bronco Bob overhears the gamblers talking to, I think it was Alabama, asking him if he'll throw the rodeo. Everyone can stand to make a lot of money. All right, so Bronco Bob overhears this and realizes what kind of a character this is, and he outsmarts him by betting against himself to the gambler for $10,000, leading the gambler to think that Bronco Bob was going to throw the match and they would bet all their money against the Lazy S. And then Bob was going to double cross the gamblers and win for the Lazy S. Okay, so that's the whole thing.
Yes.
But the gamblers have to make sure that this is going to happen. So they kidnap Alabama. Dick Foran, Bud, and Lou, they've got to go get Alabama back. So they hop in a Jeep, and they are off on Abbott and Costello's first amazing chase sequence. And boy, this one was so successful, apparently, that they did it in most of their movies. They would add a big chase or a big sequence like that. This one is killer. This one is just wonderful. It turns out that they meet the bad guys. There's a big fight. Bud and Lou immediately run away. We'll go get help. And the bad guys kidnap Dick Foran as well. So Dick Foran and Alabama, well, it kind of rhymes almost, are tied up in the villain's lair, surrounded by cowboy bad guys, and it becomes a B-Western. It becomes an honest-to-goodness B-Western at this point. The boys have to fight their way out. Alabama is wounded, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, the boys, in the meantime, run right into the Indians, who are absolutely angry and in full force. So they not only have to get help for Alabama, they have to get away from the Indians as well. So they're driving their Jeep. It's crazy. They're driving through all these great rock formations. At one point, a pigeon lands on the front of the car, and Lou says, quick, go get help. The pigeon flies out, and then he says, no, not that way, the other way. The pigeon comes back and goes the other way. Of course, they are two completely different pigeons. but that's okay. It works. And then a newspaper flies into his face, and he looks down and says, oh, look, DiMaggio got another hit. That was during DiMaggio's 1941 string, unbeaten string of hits in a row. Mm-hmm. It's so much fun. A terrible fake bear ends up in the car at one point. Iron Eyes Cody, the performer, ends up in there. Iron Eyes, who was a Hollywood Indian for about 50 years until he passed away. And then everyone found out he was from Sicily. He was a Sicilian. And nobody knew until after he died. I sat next to him at Jimmy Durante's funeral, and he was a very nice man. Very, very nice man. On the other side was Fritz Feld. So I was in between two of the great character actors of old movies. Yeah, Fritz became a buddy. Nice. So anyway, where am I going? Oh, yeah. So this chase is just fantastic. They pick them up. They pick up the heroes. They wind up at the rodeo at just the right time. Bronco Bob jumps on his horse, wins the rodeo. For some reason, he is the greatest rodeo rider and bulldogger in the world. And they win. And there's a big parade at the end. But unfortunately, Lou has to marry Moonbeam. So in the big final parade, they're singing a reprise of Ride 'em, Cowboy, Ride. We're done together side by side. I've got cheese up in my nose. And anyway, so they're riding along. And we see next to Moonbeam, she's on the horse next to him. But we slowly realize that Moonbeam isn't Moonbeam. It's Bud dressed as Moonbeam, which is almost scarier than Moonbeam. So we have the ending. The big ending comes. Everybody's happy. They win the rodeo. The gamblers lose everything. And Bronco Bob gets Anne Gwynn. We don't know what happens to Johnny Mack Brown because it was underwritten. And Bud and Lou are married to each other, and that starts a whole other story that I won't get into. There's a more adult thing I could go into. All right, so that's it.
I got to say, backing up slightly into that chase scene, two of my all-time favorite Abbott and Costello moments, period, from their entire careers, happened in that chase scene. The pigeon incident that you so beautifully described, I just remember falling off my chair the first, because he calls him, no, wait, come, and it comes back. He says, go that way. And then it goes, you know, it's like, it's a pigeon. And then later in the chase, they end up driving into a river.
Oh, that's
and
right.
And Lou gets out of the car. He's underwater. They're both under. Yeah. You can see Bud holding his nose and waving him back into the car. Lou gets out of the car, picks up a tin cup from the bottom of the river, waves it in front of his face, and then drinks the water out of the cup.
Another favorite childhood moment. Another one where my brothers and I would just fall on the floor. And then Universal was famous for their horrible dubbing. And as Bud and Lou are driving out of the river, they're still underwater. You could hear Lou say, oh, fluid drive. They had to get that cheap joke in.
Yeah.
Against all odds, you know? So anyway, we've got, we finished with Arthur Lubin's canon with the comics. And he said towards the end, he was happy to, you know, front those films. He really loved Abbott and Costello. He loved working with them. But he was ready to quit because at that point, you know, they were into their sixth movie or something in a year?
Yeah.
This was released in 42, actually, February of 42. And they became a little jaded. They became a less easier to direct. They were huge stars, and they knew it. There were the poker games, the famous poker games that had to, you know, they had to finish the hand before they shot the next scene. The thing is, Bud and Lou actually were a bargain to Universal because of that. Because they didn't like to do more than one or two takes. So the movies moved along. They moved along, and they knew their stuff when they got in. Maybe they didn't stick to the dialogue, you know, word for word. But they gave you a show, and they gave you a show in a good amount of time. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, they were a blessing to Universal Studios, I'll tell you that. Which leads to, ironically, to MGM.
How far back did they start using three cameras on them?
Oh, yeah, that's a good
from the beginning?
I think so.
From Privates?
I think it might have been after Buck Privates when they realized that they should have the third camera. They probably went to school. I'm just guessing, honestly. Yeah, I don't know for sure. But I'm guessing that they went to school on Buck Privates and knew the way Lou worked. You know, you got to have that camera on him. So as I was saying, ironically, we were talking about them being a blessing to Universal. Their next film is part of a deal they made with MGM. And that's a movie called Rio Rita. There's a whole story behind this. It's a remake of a film from 1929 from RKO. And it starred another pair of comedians we're going to talk about in our next episode. And the big announcement, Jerry, is that we decided to record two episodes a month rather than one. And that was because of a popular request, which is very nice. And we thank you for listening. And again, I said this last time, nobody did it, but I would love for you to review our podcast, share it, tell people if you like it or not. We're trying to build an audience here. And we feel like we've got a good product and we'd love to share it. So if you can do that, that would be a wonderful thing. In the meantime, Jerry, I want to give you a big hand on your opening.
Thank you.
As my proctologist used to say. And have a great, great opening night. And I know you're going to be wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Okay. We would like to say thank you to everybody for listening. And please, if you like us, please, you know, give us a hand. And if you want to see more about what I do, go to www.nicksantamaria.com. And my book can be ordered there. It can be ordered on Amazon or anywhere that sells books. And Jerry, as always, an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
And back at you, my friend. Thank you very much.
Take care, everyone.
It's the Big Podcast. It's the one where we meet Bud and Lou with a real podcast. Meaning me and Jerry too. We discuss movies, only those that feature you know who. Lou and Abbott become a habit as they meet the podcast.